From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We've got a Democratic Party that talks about its roots again, its core issues again. Finally, Democrats in Washington have learned that they can stand up to the most right-wing president that we've had in my lifetime, and that, guess what, if you stand up and you say what you believe, the voters actually like it.
After a third-place finish in Wisconsin, Howard Dean launches a full-scale attack on the Democratic Party establishment. Kerry comes in first, Edwards a close second. The Bush administration has been described Tunisia as a key ally in the war on terror. We'll take a look at the human rights and press freedom record in the country as President Bush greets the Tunisian president at the White House. And gay couples are getting married in San Francisco by the hundreds. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator John Kerry squeezed by Senator John Edwards last night to win the Wisconsin Democratic primary, a surprisingly close race. Kerry won with about 40% of the vote. Edwards received 34%. Polls leading up to the primary showed Kerry had a commanding lead, and Edwards coming in distant second. Analysts say Edwards won over many voters in the lead-up to primary day by focusing primarily on jobs and trade. The Los Angeles Times is reporting Howard Dean will stop campaigning but will not formally drop out in order to leave his name on the ballot. Last night, Dean headed back to his home state of Vermont, where he's expected to announce that decision today. In other election news, voters in Kentucky elected former State Attorney General Ben Chandler to Congress in the first federal election of 2004. Chandler became the first Democrat since 1991 to win a Republican-held seat in a special election. But the election may become best remembered not for the candidates, but the fundraising techniques. Chandler raised over $100,000 in campaign donations from across the country through ads on liberal websites. Writing on the site Talking Points Memo, Joshua Marshall says the election may prove that internet can do for Democratic fundraising what direct mail solicitations did for the Republican Party. Marshall writes, quote, "For the first time in a long time, Democrats have a technology, a mechanism that is allowing them to raise large sums of money, not from a few well-heeled givers, but from large numbers of energized Democrats." And many liberal websites have already started raising money for the next special congressional election, which takes place in South Dakota on June 1st. In the Iraqi city of Hilla, south of Baghdad, 11 Iraqis died and 58 foreign troops were wounded in a double suicide car bombing at a military base today. Guards at the base managed to stop one of the cars, but the second car exploded after smashing into a wall. Haitian Prime Minister Yvan Neptune said yesterday, "We are witnessing the coup d'etat machine in motion." Neptune said international assistance is needed after nearly 2 weeks of violence orchestrated by opponents of the government have left dozens of people dead. Agence France-Presse reports that United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is considering taking some role in the country, and France said it would consider sending peacekeepers. Meanwhile, the White House publicly urged President Aristide to take, quote, "essential steps to change how he governs the nation." The New York Times is reporting the United States has begun working closely with the Pakistani military to crack down on suspected supporters of al-Qaeda. The Times reports Pakistani troops go into villages, give the village leaders a list of wanted men. If the suspects are not handed over, the Pakistani military punishes the entire village by either withdrawing funds or demolishing houses. The U.S. commander in the area praised the tactics by saying, quote, "They're confronting the tribal elders and they're holding them accountable for activities in their areas of influence. It's a major step forward." A federal prosecutor in Detroit has filed a lawsuit against Attorney General John Ashcroft, and two other officials within the Justice Department. The suit alleges Ashcroft interfered with the prosecutor's case and conducted a smear campaign against him and received a, quote, lack of support and cooperation, lack of effective assistance, and lack of resources. Ashcroft is also accused of outing one of the prosecution's informants. The prosecutor, Richard Convertino, is an assistant U.S. attorney and has been involved in one of the most high-profile terrorism cases. The International Committee of the Red Cross has condemned the construction of the massive Israeli wall through much of the West Bank and called on Israel to stop the project. The Red Cross said the wall went, quote, far beyond what is permissible for an occupying power. The Swiss organization also noted the wall will deprive thousands of Palestinians access to water, health care, and education. In Iran, more than 200 people have been killed and 350 more injured after a runaway train carrying gas and fertilizer exploded. On Capitol Hill, Republican and Democratic congressional leaders yesterday accused the Agriculture Department of misleading the public about a central fact in the nation's first known case of mad cow disease. For the past 2 months, the department has claimed that the animal that had tested positive for mad cow disease was a downer, which meant it was sick and could not walk. But investigation by the House Committee on Government Reform found that not to be true. The committee interviewed three eyewitnesses to the slaughter of the cow who said the cow did not appear sick at all. In a letter to Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, congressional leaders wrote that this, quote, could have serious implications for both the adequacy of the National Mad Cow Surveillance System and the credibility of the USDA.
America, how are you? I'm just calling to check in. So lately you've not been yourself. I think you've forgotten something. You've forgotten yourself. You've forgotten who you are. You've become the midnight bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets with bootleggers in the back. Got the cops out in the front room, making sure the decks are stacked. And you think that you are winning, but this ain't no poker game. 'Cause you're not looking out the front door to see the ones who curse your name. 'Cause you've stolen and you've plundered in the name of liberty. Sold your soul to the highest bidder, and still you claim that you are free. So I'm calling to remind you there's still a chance for change. Take a deep look inside, see the beauty that remains.
America Luckett, America, how are you? Oh, this is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last night's Wisconsin primary shook up the race for the Democratic Party presidential nomination. Senator John Edwards made a last-minute surge against John Kerry, nearly beating the Massachusetts senator. In the end, Kerry beat out Edwards by 6 percentage points. But what's significant is that Edwards was polling at just 9% as early as last week, and Kerry was predicted to take the state in a landslide. In Wisconsin, Edwards hammered away at the themes of jobs and opposition to so-called free trade agreements like now. NAFTA. In a moment, we'll be joined by journalist John Nichols in Madison, Wisconsin for a report. But first, we'll go to the comments of Howard Dean last night. Dean came in a distant third. He told his supporters he would quit the race if he did not win in Wisconsin. But he later backed away from that statement. Today, there's a report in the Los Angeles Times that says Dean will end his campaign but will stay in the race until the convention so that his supporters can continue to vote for him and have a say in the convention. Last night, Dean launched a scathing attack on the Democratic Party establishment and other Democratic candidates.
I know that some of you are disappointed because we didn't do as well as we'd hoped we would do in Wisconsin. But I also want you to think for a moment about how far we have come. There are a lot of people in this room that are young. And when you're young, you never think things go as fast as you'd like them to go. But the truth is, change is tough. And there's enormous institutional pressure in this country against change. There's enormous institutional pressure in Washington against change, in the Democratic Party against change, and you have already started to change the Democratic Party, and we will not stop. You have already written the platform of the Democratic Party for this election. A year ago, the Democrats were falling all over each other to vote for the war in Iraq. They sure don't talk like that now. A year ago, the Democrats were accepting reckless budget deficits and huge tax cuts that mortgage our children's futures. They don't talk like that anymore. A year ago, they were adopting President's education policies, which leave every child behind. They all voted for it, but they don't support it anymore. Some of them even adopted the phony Medicare bill, which gives more money to HMOs and insurance companies and drug companies than it does to seniors, but they don't talk like that anymore. Finally, we've got a Democratic Party that talks about its roots again, its core issues again. Finally, Democrats in Washington have learned that they can stand up to the most right-wing president that we've had in my lifetime, and that, guess what, if you stand up and you say what you believe, the voters actually like it. We are not done. A year ago, Democrats were getting ready to run the 2004 campaign just like they always have in the past and just like the Republicans did. They were asking for those large donations from all those special interests in Washington, collecting all that bundled money from special interests, and you showed them that we don't have to do that anymore. You showed them you can raise more money than the special interests can, dollar by dollar, $25, $50 at a time from ordinary people. A quarter of all the people who gave money to our campaign were under 30 years old. That hasn't happened since I was under 30 years old, and that was a long time ago. But we have a long way to go. In order to change America, we have to fundamentally change Washington, both the Democrats and the Republicans. Russ Feingold and John McCain passed a great campaign finance bill. It is not enough. We need real campaign finance reform to get the special interests out of Washington. You have done that, and we are not done yet together. This campaign has been about giving the power in this country back to ordinary people, taking it away from the big corporations who move their headquarters to Bermuda and their jobs to China, and giving power and jobs back to ordinary Americans again. But we are not done yet. 56 years ago, Harry Truman promised health insurance to every man, woman, and child in America. 56 years later, special interests giving money to both parties have stopped that dream from being realized. We are not done yet until every American, man, woman, and child has health insurance like all those other countries in the world.
Howard Dean, last night in Wisconsin. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to John Nichols, who was following John Edwards on the campaign trail in Wisconsin, editor of the Capital Times newspaper in Madison and a correspondent for The Nation magazine. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
It's a Pleasure to be with you.
Well, so
after an interesting result.
That's right.
Yeah.
From polls saying Senator John Edwards was a distant third, polling around 9% to, well, coming in second, giving Kerry a run for his money.
Mm-hmm.
Your response, what happened?
Well, I think a lot happened. And the most important thing is that we finally, after a number of weeks in which the candidates were drawn to many different states and it was sort of an unfocused contest, you focus the contest down to one state. We kind of returned to the situation we were in before Iowa. And the candidates all gave a good deal of time to Wisconsin. Dean essentially camped out in the state. But Edwards didn't just give time. He also gave a theme. He said about 10 days ago that he was going to make a stand in Wisconsin against Kerry. He was going to try and make it a two-person race. And he was going to try and do that by focusing on essentially a single issue, and that was U.S. trade policy and globalization. And he really did do it. It wasn't just talk. He restructured his speech to bring in a great many references to trade policy, not just NAFTA, but Fast Track and CAFTA and the Australian trade deal that's currently up. And he restructured his television ads. And for one of the first times in political history, really at least going back to late 80s when Dick Gephardt did a little in Iowa, a candidate ran his entire television campaign focused on an economic issue, in this case trade. And it was just stunning. The response around the state was electric. You saw people coming to the Edwards rallies just to check him out. They were interested. And remember, in a lot of small-town Wisconsin, they don't see that many presidential candidates. But what they heard really appealed to them. And it wasn't just the trade. The trade was sort of the thing that got people in the door. But there was a great resonance in his Two Americas message. He talked about real class distinctions in the United States. And he did one other thing that was very interesting. Wisconsin is an overwhelmingly white state. And yet, at every rally, no matter where he was, in the smallest rural towns, in the cities, wherever, he talked about race, and he did so very bluntly. And he got incredibly good responses. So it was a fascinating campaign to watch, and there's no question that Edwards read the situation right.
We're talking to John Nichols of The Nation and the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. The Capital Times coming out endorsing John Edwards. It was interesting last night to see the victory speeches, even for those who didn't win, like John Edwards, because he moved so high up at the end. It certainly was a victory speech of sorts. Edwards started, but then Kerry gave his speech, and of course all the cameras moved to Kerry. And as we listened to Kerry, it was as if we had not moved away from Edwards, the famous Two America speech John Kerry was giving it.
You are so exactly right. I was bouncing between these different events, and if you closed your eyes and imagined that John Kerry was an interesting speaker, which is a big leap, his lines were straight out of Edwards. He grabbed the Two Americas theme. He grabbed the trade theme. John Kerry, who's one of the most passionate backers of free trade, whose voting record essentially parallels that of the Bush administration's demands on this issue, was suddenly talking about the need to re-examine NAFTA, to rewrite these trade deals, to come at it with a pro-worker, pro-environment, pro-human rights stance. And he also, for the first time that I know of, made some explicit references to the issue of poverty. And remember that that's been a theme of Edwards from the start, that the United States has to address the fact that 35 million Americans live in poverty.
We want to go for a minute to the debate in Milwaukee on Sunday night when John Kerry and John Edwards went at it on the issue of trade. The questioner was Mike Gushee.
This state has seen the loss of 90,000 manufacturing jobs since 1999. Just last week, Tower Automotive, a company that does business here in Milwaukee, announced that it was going to be shipping 500 jobs from Milwaukee to Mexico. Given that backdrop, I'd like to have Craig Gilbert ask the next question. Craig.
Senator Kerry, a lot of people here blame trade policy for those job losses, and you voted for a lot of these trade deals, NAFTA with Mexico and permanent trade relations with China. Given all the jobs that have fled to China and Mexico, would you vote the same way today?
Let me make it very clear that in those trade agreements, we passed sidebar provisions, side agreements in NAFTA on labor and environment, central agreements in the China trade agreement on surge, if there's a surge of imports or if there's a dumping that takes place, we have things that we can do. This administration refuses to do them, number one. Number two, there's been a dramatic shift in the world in what has happened to jobs over the course of the last few years. Perhaps 3 or 4 years ago, I began talking about how it is critical that in any trade agreement, we now need to negotiate labor and trade, labor and environment standards. I will order a 120-day review of all of our trade agreements. We're going to see what's working, what isn't. I will not sign a trade agreement like the Central American Free Trade Agreement or the Free Trade of Americas Act that does not now embrace enforceable labor and environment standards. And we need to be creating more jobs here in the United States of America. I have a $50 billion package that I'll make available for manufacturing incentives and for relief for the states in order to help create the jobs we need in America, as well as a $4,000 tuition tax credit for kids to be able to go to college. We're going to refocus on science and technology on the United States. We're going to do the stem cell research and all of the other kinds of commitment to science that will advance the creation of jobs here at home. This president thinks it's enough just to raise the stock market. I don't.
But no,
I think a president needs to put America back to work.
But no, no regrets about those votes.
I regret the way that they haven't been enforced. Sure.
Senator Evers, let me just turn to you first. I mean, you said the other day that there are obvious differences between you and Senator Kerry on this issue. What are they?
This is one. This is the one you just asked about as an obvious example. You know, Senator Kerry is entitled, as is Governor Dean, to support free trade, as they always have. The problem is there, what we see happening, and it's NAFTA, which I opposed, plus a whole series of other trade agreements, have been devastating here in Wisconsin. Nobody has to tell me what the effect is of some of these bad trade agreements. I have seen it myself. My father worked in a mill. I saw what happened when the mill in my hometown closed. I saw the looks on the faces of the men and women who had worked there, many of them for decades, and had nowhere to go. You mentioned Tower Automotive just a minute ago. I went to Tower Automotive, met with some of the employees who were about to be laid off. That vacant look, what do I do now? I've worked hard and been responsible for decades, raised my family, done what I'm supposed to. What do I do now? It all looked very familiar to me. And the voters of Wisconsin deserve to know this is something I will take very personally. I will stand up and fight every way I know how to protect these jobs, including the jobs that are being lost at Tower and Automotive, because I have lived with this in my entire life, and I take it very personally.
Senator John Edwards, Senator John Kerry, talking about trade. We're going to go to break, be back with John Nichols in a moment, and then move on to other issues. Thousands of gay couples getting married in San Francisco, a possible coup d'etat in Haiti, and we'll look at the Tunisian human rights record. Stay with us.
It's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right. Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely winter. Little darling, you've been here. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
Nina Simone. Here comes the sun here on Democracy Now! War and Peace Report as we look at the Wisconsin primary results. John Kerry, about 40%. John Edwards, 34%. Howard Dean, a distant third. We're on the line with John Nichols of the Madison Times and The Nation magazine. John, we just heard Edwards and Kerry debating the issue of trade. I'm looking at a piece from almost a year ago from the Charlotte Observer, which quotes Edwards campaign pollster Harrison Hickman, saying the record shows Edwards has voted more conservatively than all but 10 other Democratic senators and that he has supported Bush on homeland security and the war with Iraq. Hickman, who's a North Carolina native, said by any measure, he is closer to the center than the left, just like the state of North Carolina. It's also something Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun charged in one of the debates, saying he's one of the most conservative Democratic senators in the Senate, and he objected to this. But she's saying exactly what his own pollster was saying.
I think that you're right. I think his pollster is right on some issues. You know, a lot of these measures are complex. One of the things is that in the Congressional Quarterly studies and some of the others, Edwards has a record of voting against President Bush more than any other Democrat. So if you look at that, you can make the case that Edwards isn't a conservative. You can look at some other measures, Homeland Security, the War, Patriot Act, and a number of other initiatives, and you see that Edwards, like Kerry, voted with Bush. And I think you have to be careful about, I think people have to be careful about seeing John Edwards as this great left-wing choice or even a particularly progressive choice. He came into this race much like Howard Dean, who, of course, came in as an extremely conservative former governor of Vermont, and altered himself, evolved as the race went on. And I think that the one thing about Edwards that's been striking is that whether it's sincere or not, when he speaks in public, he comes off as someone who actually is at least aware of the fact that there is a deep class divide in the United States. He talks about it a lot. He also comes off as someone who's quite aware that there are an awfully lot of race issues that remain profoundly unsettled. And I think that people are responding to that certainly more than his record. I don't think most people know the guy's record that much any more than they know Kerry's. I think what's coming through on the trail, at least, is that Edwards is talking about stuff that people understand in a very visceral, very real sense. And none of the other candidates, with the exception of Al Sharpton, has kind of focused in so closely on these race and class issues.
Howard Dean, you've been covering him. You extensively were in Iowa, where you see him going now. The Los Angeles Times saying that he might not campaign, but he also might not pull out to let this be decided at the convention, give his power to the people who have been supporting him all this time.
Well, Dean's in a very complex place. He's sort of like General Lee after Gettysburg. He has a very large army that's very hard to demobilize, but he hasn't won. And so he's got to figure out what to do. The fact is that Dean's supporters are incredibly passionate. I've been talking to a lot of them over the last few days, not just in Wisconsin, but around the country. There's a lot of people who really believe in the guy and who have profound doubts about Kerry, Edwards, and most of the leadership of the Democratic Party. Dean's in a powerful position. Despite the fact that he didn't win, he consistently was posting, you know, in a lot of these primaries, 10, 20, 25% finishes. And so you know that in states across the country, he has a substantial base of supporters. He's going to give a press conference at noon today. Nobody's quite sure what he's going to say. He's been quite erratic as regards direction of the campaign in the last week or so. But there are actually two things he could possibly do. I don't think there's any chance that he completely ends the campaign and says it's over and he's getting out. One is he could suspend the campaign. Many candidates do this. You just say, look, I'm not really going to campaign much anymore, but I'm going to let my name remain on the ballot, and if my supporters in particular states want to campaign for me, they can. Paul Tsongas did that in 1992 and actually ended up getting a lot of delegates after he'd stopped campaigning. The other option he has is to sort of put the campaign on hold, not officially finish it, but say, look, you know, don't go out and vote for me. Vote for one of these other guys. And today, both Edwards and Kerry are lobbying Dean very passionately for an endorsement. And I can tell you that in the last few days in Wisconsin, when Dean talked about the other candidates, he was quite harsh on Kerry and relatively enthusiastic about Edwards. He said a lot of positive things about Edwards. So there's some speculation that it's possible he might make an endorsement or encourage his supporters to at least look at one of these other candidates. And my sense is that Edwards probably has the upper hand among the two. But you really have to tune in at noon Eastern time because with Howard Dean, you know, things do change along the way, and you're never quite sure until he says it, what he's where he's going to head.
Well, John Nichols, thanks very much for being with us of the Medicine Times and the Nation. This is Democracy Now! Haitian Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune said yesterday, we're witnessing a coup d'etat machine in motion. Neptune said international assistance was needed after nearly 2 weeks of violence orchestrated by opponents of the government has left dozens of people dead. Agence France-Presse reports UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is considering taking some role in the country. France says it's considering sending in peacekeepers. Meanwhile, the White House publicly urged President Aristide to take, quote, essential steps to change how he governs the nation. We're on the line with Kim Ives of Haiti Progrès, who's recently returned from Haiti. What's happening in the country right now, Kim?
Well, Amy, it's looking an awful lot like Congo 1960. You know, we see former colonial and slave-owning powers fomenting a rebellion against President Aristide, just as they did against Patrice Lumumba back then. And we see, in fact, wealthy businessmen leading the rebellion against the government, much like the Congo. And we see Aristide on the verge of requesting peacekeepers again, as Lumumba did, but we know in the case of the Congo that those UN peacekeepers that came in disarmed Lumumba's troops, helping the rebellion against him, and in the end result, there was a coup by Mobutu, which turned him over to his killers. And we're hoping that scenario isn't reproducing. We see France, Haiti's colonial master, saying it's ready to act, come in, send in an intervention force. This is the same country that has been fomenting the rebellion over the past months. It's French diplomats who have been funding the principal opposition radio station in Haiti, who have been chaperoning and supporting the opposition leaders in trips around the country and marches. And now they're claiming they're coming to help resolve the situation. And I don't, it's a little unclear whether France is working independently or as a surrogate for the U.S. We know that between these two powers, the Caribbean is seen as the U.S. backyard. So it may be, and this is something Washington has done often, it pushes Canada or France, the two other principal powers with a lot of influence in Haiti and economic interests, to the fore while they hang back. So it's I don't think people should take the declarations of Secretary of State Colin Powell, who says there's, quote-unquote, no enthusiasm for an intervention. On the contrary, we feel the U.S. has had the heaviest hand in the affairs of Haiti, and I have been trying to bring it precisely to this point where they can point to anarchy in the country or supposed anarchy and say, well, clearly these are people who cannot govern themselves and they need foreign intervention.
Kim, what about the former coup leaders, people like Raoul Cedras, people like Emmanuel Constant, who walks free in the United States, former head of FRAP, was on the intelligence agency, U.S. intelligence agency payroll, fomenting the coup 91 to 94.
Yeah, exactly. And we see now Toto Constant, who is presently, we believe at least, enjoying a very golden political asylum here in Queens, New York.
Is there any sign that any of them are returning to Haiti?
Yes, indeed. The number two of the FRAP organization, Louis Jodel Chamblain, showed up in Gonaïves last week at the head of a column of all-terrain vehicles and guys dressed in camouflage gear with rifles. And in fact, he led the assault on the central plateau town of Hache, where the police chief and his bodyguard were killed in the assault. They emptied the prison, as they do in each case when they take a town, often recruiting troops from the convicts. And then they burned down the police station. So now Chamblain is in it, and if you ever wanted better proof that terrorists are involved in this uprising, you have it right there.
Well, Kim Ives, I want to thank you for being with us. We will continue to follow the story in Haiti very closely. Kim Ives is editor of the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to San Francisco, where thousands of gay couples are getting married. Gay couples seeking marriage licenses have flocked to City Hall for the fifth day after two conservative groups failed to block the marriages in two separate lawsuits in state court. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom last week ordered city officials to begin issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Officials changed the wording on marriage licenses to make them gender neutral, and since then have performed over 2,600 same-sex marriages. Marriage licenses are being issued in defiance of state law. Newsom has argued that the Equal Protection Clause of the California Constitution makes denying marriage licenses to gay couples illegal. We're joined right now by Kate Kendall, Executive Director of the San Francisco-based National Center for Lesbian Rights. She was the official witness at the first marriage at City Hall of the lesbian couple who'd been together for more than half a century. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you describe that marriage?
Oh, gosh. Every time I think of it, I get emotional. It was a very profound moment. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon are friends of mine, in addition to mentors and icons for women generally, based on the work they've done, and certainly for lesbian and gay folks in this country more specifically. And it was really amazing to hear them be able to, for the first time in almost 51 years, be able to publicly declare their commitment to each other and to have a government entity support and recognize that commitment. It truly was moving.
Kate Kendall, can you talk about what is happening? You've got more than 2,600 marriages at this point, and they are continuing. You've got a number of court decisions now. Wasn't a third issuing a decision last night?
Yes, there have been a couple of different court actions brought by anti-gay organizations to stop the issuance of marriage licenses. And yesterday, there was a key hearing on two of those organizations asking for a temporary restraining order, which the judge denied in the sense that he said he was not going to stop the marriages that day because the standard was not met. That is, the organizations had to prove that someone was being harmed by the issuance of these marriage licenses, and they simply could not demonstrate that in a way that met the legal standard. So what the court has ordered is that the city, the formal language is that the city cease and desist issuing marriage licenses, or, and the or is the most important part of this sentence, or come back into court at a hearing date that's now been scheduled for March 29th and explain to the court why they did not comply with the court's order to stop. And at that point, the court will have a full hearing on whether there is sufficient grounds for issuing a preliminary injunction to stop the issuance of marriage licenses. And then this Friday, there is another hearing on the other action brought by the other organizations. But I think the best bet would be that that court would do the same thing this court did yesterday, and licenses would continue to be issued until there can be a full hearing on a preliminary injunction.
Well, last Thursday, Sarah Connor and her partner Jillian Smith went to San Francisco City Hall and became the second same-gender couple in the U.S. to be granted a marriage license. Sarah Connor joins us on the line as well. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you describe your wedding?
It was a real whirlwind, but it was just an incredible, amazing experience. I can't express the joy that was just filling the room. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to let our family and friends know. But just in this room full of people that we had just met, I just felt this outpouring of love and support.
How did you decide to get married?
Well, we decided a long time ago that we wanted to be married, and that was the only word we could really think of that felt appropriate to describe the relationship that we wanted. This opportunity came up. A friend of mine called me the night before before Thursday and said, you know, do you want to get married at City Hall tomorrow? We had been planning on eloping to Toronto, where we could be married there. But, you know, we could do it at home, and that was better. So we thought, yeah, absolutely.
And so you're married. The certificate you have, this means you're married in any state in this country?
It means we're married in California right now. I don't know about other states.
Well, let me ask Kate Kendall. People are flying in, couples are flying in from all over the country to get married. And some are saying that they'll go back home to their own states and file suit so that this marriage is recognized. Can you talk about the legality of this?
Well, it is our position that these couples have the same kind of marriage license any other couple would get from any other county clerk if they choose to marry in a state in which they don't live. And that the traditional course in this country, given that we are a United States, not 50 different countries, is that that marriage license would be recognized and respected, and our position is that is the proper legal and constitutional thing to do, to grant these licenses the kind of equality and respect that any other license would be given. But we know that this continues to be a somewhat divisive issue for folks who are not sure exactly whether they approve of this kind of equality and fairness for lesbian and gay couples, and I'm sure that inevitably there will be more lawsuits. But I truly do, watching what's happened over the course of the last 10 days, I do think that a wide swath of the public in this country has seen joyful, ecstatic lesbians and gay men lining up in the rain to get a marriage license and to have the government confirm that their relationship is recognized and respected in the eyes of the law. And I do think this is having a profound effect on people's perception of the reality of lesbian and gay lives and the importance of having that kind of governmental security and protection for our relationships. And I'm hoping that during a time of turbulence, that will be a short time, and that eventually, quite quickly, the issue will be settled and these relationships will be accorded legal recognition.
Meanwhile, Kate Kendall, the Georgia State Senate approved Tuesday a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage and defining marriage as only between a man and a woman. And the Boston Globe is reporting Republican legislators in New Hampshire are pushing a bill that would specifically prohibit recognition of same-sex marriages performed in other states.
Yes, I think that some kind of response to this is inevitable from folks. I mean, there have always been those in every civil rights struggle who have been either felt threatened by or who have been hostile to full equality and embracing of difference and assuring that everyone has equal protection under the laws in this very important constitutional democracy that we live in. But I believe the march of progress is forward. And that, in fact, there will be a moment, hopefully soon, where this issue is settled and these relationships and these couples, many of them with children, have legal recognition by not only the state government, but by the federal government as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much both for joining us. We've been talking to Kate Kendall, Executive Director of National Center for Lesbian Rights in San Francisco, and Sarah Connor, who married her partner Jillian Smith, the second couple to get married at San Francisco City Hall last Thursday. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Democracy Now! California Dreamin', the Mamas and the Papas here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is scheduled to meet with the Tunisian president today at the White House. It's the first visit to Washington by an Arab leader since Bush unveiled his so-called Initiative for Democracy in the Middle East. Tunisia is seen by Washington as a key ally in the war on terror. They receive modest U.S. military aid. The two countries conduct joint military exercises. Secretary of State Colin Powell on Tuesday saluted the Tunisian president as a strong friend and praised the Tunisian government, but advised him to put more effort into political reform. We turn now to two guests, Kamel Labidi, who is an independent journalist, former director of the Tunisian section of Amnesty International, and Mahdi Bray, executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. Kamel Labidi, can you talk about the significance of this meeting and the situation in Tunisia?
Well, thank you for inviting me to give my views on Tunisia on the occasion of President Ben Ali's visit to the U.S. Tunisians do not think much of this visit because it's comes at a time when the Bush administration states its commitment to democracy in the Middle East and North Africa, but at the same time they are still under the heavy grip of a dictatorship. So this visit might be a good opportunity for President Bush to mean that he is serious about his commitment, because his commitment to see democracy spread in the region would ring hollow.
Human rights groups have called on President Bush to press the Tunisian President Ben Ali to allow more freedoms and dissent. The Tunisian Human Rights League, the country's only legal independent rights group, reports the government routinely beats dissidents and rights campaigners and muzzles the press. You yourself, Kamel Labidi, left Tunisia in 1996 because you were denied the right to work. Why?
Why? Because since Mr. Ben Ali came to power 17 years ago and promised to democratize Tunisia, he overthrew in a bloodless coup his aging predecessor and promised to push the country on the road to democracy and the rule of law. But repression has never stopped widening since he came to power, and he. The press has been muzzled, and independent journalists have been silenced. Some of them have been forced to leave the country. Others remained silent. Some others were thrown in jail. There is no room in Tunisia for independent journalism, and you have got to pay a heavy price if you want to express your thoughts as an independent journalist. In January, it's still going on. In January, one of the independent journalists, Siham Ben Sidrine, she was beaten up in the streets of Tunis near her home because the Tunisian government is not ready to accept any dissenting view. And other journalists have been. For the time being, there are two journalists in prison, Jedali and Souari, and they have been detained since the early 90s. And 2 months ago, one journalist was released from prison after 15 of arbitrary imprisonment because he criticized Mr. Ben Ali on his website.
We're talking to Kamel Labidi, who is an independent journalist, former director of the Tunisian section of Amnesty International. He is now talking to us from his home in Cairo. He left Tunisia in 1996. Mahdi Bray on the line with us also from Washington, D.C., executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. What are you doing today as the president meets with the president of Tunisia?
Well, we're participating in a massive phone blitz all across the country, asking people to call in to, first of all, protest even the very visit of Ben Ali here, and to be received, you know, here at here in America. I think it's the height of hypocrisy. We turn around and we drop bombs on the people of Iraq under the standards of protecting and defending human rights, you know, and out came one despot out of a hole, and now we invite another despot to come and have dinner in Washington, D.C. at the White House. I think that's deplorable. It's once again an example of how this administration talks north, but indeed walks south. And it is indeed this type of double standard is perceived throughout the Muslim world and by Muslims and Arabs, you know, throughout the region, that certainly takes away from any credibility in terms of our ability to, as a government, to interact with the people of the region. The truth of the matter is, Ben Ali is indeed a dictator. He has an abysmal human rights record, as documented not only by Human Rights Organization, but our own State Department's report on Tunisia. Annual report on human rights speaks, you know, in glaring terms about the atrocities that take place in Tunisia, but yet it's still being held out. You know, they spend a tremendous amount of money trying to gloss over their abuses and their human rights abuses. But I'm an old country boy. You can call a mule a horse, but it doesn't make it one. The fact of the matter is, Tunisia is a very repressive regime, and Ben Ali is responsible for the leadership of this type of repression. And we are doing a great disservice to the people in the region by receiving him here in America, giving him the photo op that he's doing. So once again, we're asking people to call the White House all over the country. Yesterday, we were in front of the State Department, and we will continue to protest his presence here because I think it sends the wrong signal to the Muslim world. But I think it sends the wrong signal on the issue of human rights in general.
On that note, Mahdi Bray, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation, and Kamal Labidi, independent journalist from Tunisia, now living in Cairo in exile. We did try to get the Tunisian embassy on the line. They did not return our calls. As we turn now to our last segment, tonight the movie channel Cinemax will premiere a new documentary called Horns and Halos, which follows J.H. Hatfield, the author of a controversial biography on George W. Bush, and his publishing house, Soft Skull Press. The book called Fortunate Son was intended to be what's called a clip job, a book based primarily on newspaper clippings and already published material. It was rushed out in 1998 when it became clear that George Bush was on the rise as a Republican candidate for president. J.H. Hatfield, the author, had previously assembled quickie unauthorized bios on Ewan McGregor and Patrick Stewart. What made this book different was the use of stories that Hatfield encountered providing evidence that George W. Bush had been arrested for cocaine and that his father had acted to have the arrest expunged from the police record. His publisher, St. Martin's Press, referred to the book as its new MJ, or Michael Jordan, and upped the number of books in the first publishing run several times, thinking it would be a hot seller. Then came the news, unearthed by the Dallas Morning News, that author Hatfield had served time for solicitation of capital murder. St. Martin's said this diminished Hatfield's credibility. They withdrew the book. Hatfield accused the Bush family of intimidating the publisher. But then the head of a small publishing house, Soft Skull Press, bought up the rights of the book and ultimately published it. They, too, were sued on another issue. The documentary that follows this whole story, called Horns and Halos, will be airing tonight on Cinemax. It's directed by Suki Hawley and Michael Galinsky, who join us both in our Firehouse studios. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks so much for having us.
J.H. Hatfield, the author of the book, who we did interview on Democracy Now! Years ago, allegedly committed suicide. In what year?
It was 2001.
2001. Can you talk about the significance of your film coming out now and showing across the country?
Well, actually, our film has been showing across the country for the last year theatrically. It does have its big release tonight on Cinemax. And it is significant because of the primaries that are going on across the country. And just especially with the National Guard issue coming up with Bush, which also was in the book, and Hatfield explained in detail, and the book was ignored during the last campaign.
Yeah, because the movie is really largely It follows two people. It's not, you know, a slag on Bush. The movie really follows these people through their story. But the subtext is about media and the way stories move through the media. And so, for instance, there's a lot of stuff in the book that wasn't discussed. The Harkin Energy story, the Texas Rangers, all these things that were well known, as you said, they were part of a clip job. They were well known, they were well reported, but they weren't really reported on during the campaign. And that's kind of what's interesting because it's kind of coming up now.
J.H. Hatfield, I think in the subsequent editions, the allegations of cocaine use were taken out. Is that right?
No. In fact, they were sued over an introduction that Hatfield wrote in the new Soft Skull edition, where he basically explained his criminal past, which is what caused St. Martin's to drop the book. That was taken out after a lawsuit was settled, mm-hmm. Agreeing to take that out. But in fact, the cocaine allegations were left in the book.
He said, and something that was controversial was, he said that Carl Rove had leaked to him the issue of the cocaine use. I want to go to a clip of the film, and it's when J.H. Hatfield is being questioned by reporters at a book fair.
Yeah.
Carl Rove was the man who J.H. Hatfield said he spoke to, which is hard to believe. Why would Karl Rove out Bush?
Well,
in
what
this
he
way?
Alleges in this press conference is that Rove called him because he wanted to cross the T's and dot the I's in the book and make sure everything was correct. And then Hatfield said he went back to Rove when he had the story and he played poker with him, is what he says in this press conference. And he said, well, you know, I'm going to go. I have other sources. Do you want to put your spin on it? You know, as far as we were concerned, this was a questionable aspect of the book. And we leave that in the film, letting him, you know, he says it, but none of the reporters at that event ever questioned Rove about it, and nobody reported on it except for Page Six.
Let's see the press conference.
Paul Rove is your source on the cocaine arrest?
Well, Sanders kind of put me between a rock and a hard spot. But now with the relaunching of this new edition, yeah, Carl Rove was one of my major sources.
Why would Carl Rove tell you that, and how do you know that he was telling the truth?
He contacted me the first time in June of 1999. The book was finished. It was turned in. I had a May deadline in St. Martin's Press. He just said, I'm a Bush campaign person. I want to make sure the nuts and bolts are correct. And I corroborated everything he told me that weekend with secondary and third sources.
An excerpt of Horns and Halos. We only have a few seconds. You can conclude it.
Well, I was just going to say, he alleges this. That's one of the questionable aspects of the book. The meat of the book, you know, if you forget the cocaine story, is a lot of important information that wasn't discussed during the campaign, and that was what was very significant to us as we followed the story. The Harkin Energy letter was in this book. The, you know, information about Bush draft dodging, information about how he got the Texas Rangers and a land grab, et cetera. This is all in the book, but not discussed during the campaign.
And this film will be on Cinemax tonight. I want to thank you both for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm.